You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
Wyndham Hotels and Resorts makes travel possible for all. Whether it's the long haulers looking for a great cup of coffee, a roomier rest for the on a whim road trippers, or a place to make summer memories with the whole family. No matter who you are, where you're going, or why, with 24 trusted brands to choose from like La Quinta, Days Inn, and Super 8, your Wyndham is waiting. Get the lowest price at WyndhamHotels.com. Restrictions apply. Visit website for more details.
Today's episode is brought to you by our supporters on Patreon, including our Commodores. That's Commodores Kane, Kinway, Hefe, Zuman, Antonio, Drunken Dak, The Pirate Nopales, Matthew the Navigator, Bull, Vertigon, Conifalinde, Rumgut, and Bootstraps Bailey. And this week we welcome a new Quartermaster, Samuel, and as always, our Quartermaster, Heather. Hello. Welcome to the Pirate History Podcast. My name is Matt. Thank you for listening. I'd like to talk very briefly about English colonization in the New World and the English Civil War. I want to blow through these things because today we get to delve into the really juicy early days of pirate mythos. So let's skip the preamble here and just jump in. This is episode 103, The Story So Far, Part 4. English colonization began under Queen Elizabeth. She tasked Humphrey Gilbert and Walter Raleigh with finding and establishing New World colonies in Newfoundland and Roanoke, neither of which would last. Her successor, King James I, oversaw the successful colonization of Bermuda and Virginia, but any West Indian attempts under his reign were less successful. His son and heir, Charles I, King of England, had more luck in West Indian colonization. His colonial establishments happened in rapid succession. St. Kitts, it was called St. Christopher Island at the time, Nevis, and Barbados. There was a little hiccup in 1531 when Providence Island was unsuccessfully captured by a group of Puritan pirates, what we talked about last time, and their biggest mistake was attempting to take an island that was deep in Spanish territory. It was close to Nicaragua, Jamaica, Cuba, and Panama, and that was something the Spanish would not tolerate. But after that, successful English colonization continued. They added Antigua, Barbuda, and Montserrat in 1632 alone, and they were nearly all in the Leeward Islands. At the very least, they were all in the Lesser Antilles. And all of those were far from Spain's New World strongholds of Havana, Cartagena, Maracaibo, and Veracruz. The closest Spanish stronghold was Puerto Rico, but that wasn't as powerful as those other cities. All of this English rush toward Caribbean colonization was a corporate enterprise, but it did have national and international significance. England was still involved in the 30 Years' War at the time, and all of these land seizures were an American theater of that war. The colonization effort slowed significantly, though, when England began to fall apart internally and when the monarchy went up in flames. King Charles I was a deeply unpopular monarch, largely due to unfair and illegal taxation and religion. He very nearly married the Catholic Infanta of Spain. Now that fell apart, but he did go on to marry Henrietta Maria, the Catholic Princess of France. Due to his close relationship to two powerful Catholic women, his grandmother, Mary Queen of Scots, and his new wife, there was a lot of suspicion about King Charles' religion. He attempted to enforce religious uniformity across his three dominions, England, Ireland, and Scotland, and it was a Protestant Anglican attempt, but it was still a really bad idea. His Book of Common Prayer, the primary tool of that uniformity, was hated by almost everyone. The Irish hated the Book of Common Prayer because it came from a Protestant source, Scotland hated it because it came from an English source, and England hated it because it came from Charles, and as many of them saw it, a Catholic source. There were a lot of causes for the Civil War, and there were actually three different conflicts that are usually just all collectively called the English Civil War. But, long story short, for a little over a decade, England was embroiled in a civil war between the Royalists and everyone else. That included Irish Catholics, Scottish Presbyterians, English Puritans, and English Anglicans. The English who fought against Charles are usually lumped under the umbrella of parliamentarians, people who fought for expanded parliamentary control of the government and limits on royal power. In the end, the parliamentarians won. King Charles was beheaded and his wife and children fled to France, where they would be steeped in the Catholic faith and the belief of the divine right of kings. Certainly, this would never come back to bite England. Meanwhile, back in England, things were tumultuous. When everyone has this singular goal, and a figurehead that everyone can agree to hate in the king, they could all rally behind that cause. But when it came time to build a government, that was harder. Different factions had different ideas, different religions had different ideas. But after some time and a number of different attempts at different types of government, Oliver Cromwell was named Protector of the Realm. Now, Cromwell was a military dictator. Basically, he was a king, but he wasn't tremendously popular. The problem seems to be that the English had yet to figure out how to have a government without a king. They just really didn't want one. But Cromwell was strong, militarily speaking. This period, this whole period where they didn't have a king, is called the English Commonwealth. When Cromwell was in power, it was called the Protectorate. Or, if you're a royalist, this period was called the Interregnum. It's all very complicated, and honestly, it's not that related to our story, except for one major thing. Cromwell had a nation in which half the people actively fought against him. So he had to do something. He had to either change their minds, or he had to keep them occupied, or at the very least, he had to get them far away from England so they couldn't start yet another war and destabilize his power. To this end, Cromwell settled on an old favorite in England, war with Spain, and what he called the Western Design. The Western Design was, I'd have to say, pretty brilliant. It was a plan to resume English colonization that had been on hold for about a decade due to the war. That would see England gain territory, which made people rich, and that changed a lot of minds. It would occupy royalist military leaders, and it would snatch up soldiers from royalist districts to send overseas and fight. This mitigated the threat at home quite successfully. Three birds and one stone. All of the trustworthy, reliable military commanders were busy fighting the First Anglo-Dutch War, which was going on at this time. But the less trustworthy commanders were sent off on this Western design. Men, very much, like William Penn. William Penn, the grandfather of the founder of Pennsylvania, was a parliamentarian, not a royalist. But he was a suspected traitor. In fact, the parliamentarians had already arrested him for it once. And after a successful battle in the Anglo-Dutch War, he actually offered to sail his entire fleet to France to serve the uncrowned heir to the English throne. Now that happened in 1554. And apparently, word got up to the highest rungs of government. Later that year, William Penn found himself in command of a fleet bound for the West Indies. This fleet was the primary arm of the Western design, and Penn had orders to, quote, gain an interest in that part of the West Indies in possession of the Spaniards, end quote. Now remember, according to the Pope, most of the Americas belonged to Spain, and the parts that didn't belonged to Portugal. But Spain only occupied a really small part of what, according to the Pope, belonged to them. Most of the New World didn't have any Spanish presence at all, and all of the islands that England already claimed didn't have any Spaniards there either. But Cromwell's orders didn't say capture empty lands. It said capture lands in possession of the Spaniards. And that was a purposeful use of the word possession. See, Cromwell wanted a battle. He wanted a conflict between England and Spain, and he wanted, more than anything else, a victory. There was no better way to secure your own hold on England than defeating the Spanish in a war. Now, William Pitt was only the admiral of the Western Design fleet. He was accompanied by a much more trustworthy soldier, a general named Robert Venables. Venables had served directly under Cromwell on a number of campaigns, and Cromwell knew that he could be trusted and that he was a man who could get the job done. Their fleet consisted of 17 warships and 20 troop transports, carrying 325 guns, 1,145 seamen, and 1,830 regular troops. Most of the regulars were soldiers who had fought on the Royalist side. That's not to say that any of them were actually Royalists. Many of them only fought for their local lord. However, some of them were, at one time, Royalists. Men like Edward Morgan. Edward Morgan was the commander of a Welsh unit that fought for the king during the war. That unit included his two brothers, Robert and Thomas. Now, during the war, Robert was killed, and Thomas defected. He followed his commander, a man named George Monk, over to the parliamentarian side. Thomas would actually become something of a hero and somewhat famous, but Edward continued fighting for the Royalists, and he actually took his nephew Harry, the son of his slain brother Robert, under his wing. Edward and Harry fought for the Royalists until the war ended. Both Edward and Harry were probably on board when the expedition, when the Western Design, set sail. That expedition's first major move was an attempt to capture Santo Domingo, the home of one of the largest settlements in the Caribbean, as well as the French buccaneers. Now, the English failed to capture Santo Domingo. They actually failed pretty abysmally. So bad, in fact, that both Pitt and Venables would be jailed sometime later when they returned to England. But after their defeat, I wonder if the English expedition stopped off to rest with the buccaneers on Tortuga. If they sailed north around what we today call Hispaniola, they would have had a lot fewer Spanish ships to deal with. So it's very possible that they did. Those buccaneers, if they did in fact stop at Tortuga, probably would have pointed the English toward an island just a little bit to the southwest called Jamaica. Jamaica was the island that had initially been given over to Christopher Columbus and his heirs. The colonists there found no gold, so instead they turned to growing sugar and the slave trade. Now, there is a footnote in the story of Christopher Columbus that may or may not be pertinent to the story today and to the population of Jamaica. Initially, Christopher Columbus was rebuffed when he proposed his mission to Queen Isabella. However, as Columbus was riding away, Queen Isabella's secretary convinced him to stay, and he convinced Queen Isabella to listen to him one more time. Some have even argued that he convinced the queen to give Christopher Columbus his mission. Now, that secretary was what the Spanish called a converso. That is, well, he was Catholic, but he came from a long line of Sephardi Jewish Spaniards. It has been suggested, in fact, I suggested it on this show some time ago, that there was a deal struck between this secretary and Christopher Columbus, that this secretary would agree to get Columbus his mission, but in return, Columbus had to find a suitable piece of land for the conversos, these formerly Jewish Spaniards, somewhere that they could settle, far from Spain and far from the Inquisition, where they could return to practicing their true faith in Judaism. Now, whether that actually happened, I can't say for sure, but what I can say is that a very large number of conversos settled in Jamaica after Columbus took control of it, as in, most of the Spaniards who moved there were in fact Sephardi Jews. The population of Jamaica included 696 Spaniards, many of whom were Jewish. There were also some 558 African slaves and 107 free people of color. Now, the free people of color were of mixed ancestry. Many were of Spanish and Native American parents, the mestizo. Many were of Spanish and African parents, the mulatto, and they were free, but the rights they had depended, in Spain's complex caste system, on what percentage of white Spanish ancestry they could claim. But none of them were full citizens. There were also 74 Taino people, and these were likely the wives of white Spaniards, as well as 75 foreigners. Now the foreigners, we don't exactly know who they were, but they were probably mostly Portuguese, and if that is the case, then they were absolutely Jewish. From a letter written by one of the English soldiers who was on board the Western Design, quote, "On Wednesday morning, being the 9th of May, we saw Jamaica land, very high and afar off. Wednesday the 10th, our soldiers, in numbers 7,000, the sea regiment being none of them, landed at the Three Forts," end quote. The three forts mentioned in that quote were those guarding Caguaya Bay, modern Caguay Bay, at Jamaica's spectacular natural harbor. Those forts were where most of Jamaica's unquestionably Catholic citizens lived, that is, mostly soldiers and Coast Guard who had no familial or personal connections, aside from living on Jamaica, to the mostly Jewish citizens living inland. Those soldiers and Coast Guard, though, weren't ready for this invasion. It didn't take very long. Venables disembarked his soldiers out of range of the fort's guns, while Penn sailed the fleet into the harbor and opened fire. This pulled the attention of the soldiers in the forts toward the harbor, while Venables was able to march his soldiers in and take the forts. And that's a clever move, but that's not why they won. The Spanish didn't have enough soldiers to guard the forts or man the guns within. The soldiers were not well trained, their guns were in disrepair, and their ships were not seaworthy. And remember that. Think of it as a mantra, because I'm going to be saying it a lot today. The Spanish didn't have enough soldiers to guard the forts or man the guns within. The soldiers were not well trained, their guns were in disrepair, and their ships were not seaworthy. The Spanish who were left fled into the mountains with their slaves, and they would actually plague the English for a few years with guerrilla warfare, and those slaves became the basis for Jamaica's Maroon population. But that wasn't a concern yet. The English troops moved inland toward Villa de la Vega, the primary city on Jamaica, and Villa de la Vega surrendered without a fight. But there weren't soldiers there, they were mostly merchants and plantation owners. But here's the thing. The population of Villa de la Vega, what would soon be called Spanish Town, was largely Jewish. They were conversos in the eyes of Spain, but a lot of archaeological evidence has suggested that there was at least one synagogue in town and that they practiced openly. Now, Cromwell hated the Jewish people, but England had been before and would again be very welcoming to Jewish immigrants, especially these Sephardi exiles. And the Jamaican Jews had a ton of reason to hate the Spanish government, not least of all the Inquisition, and they would turn out to be helpful allies and friendly neighbors to these English invaders. They had connections to other Sephardi communities in Holland and Morocco and Portugal, and that would really help out later when Jamaica developed a privateer economy. To put it bluntly here, the Jews of Jamaica were going to fence the goods that the pirates brought in, and this served everyone's interest because everything they did there hurt the Spanish. So the English held the forts there at Caguay Bay, as well as Spanish Town, but that was basically it. They had a fleet, but much of it went home. It left only a few of the smaller ships and about 2,000 men. So the men that were left there relied on the few supplies they had with them, as well as what they could gather from nearby farms. Unfortunately, shortly after the conquest of Jamaica, the Commonwealth began to fizzle and fall apart, so England wasn't terribly stable. Jamaica had virtually no support from home. It wasn't even a colony. They called it the Jamaica Station. And really, it was little more than a naval way station in the eyes of England, and it was a way station that didn't lead to anywhere but Spain, so nobody ever went there. The Commonwealth would send over a few ships, but they didn't have supplies on board, they had criminals on board. Jamaica was little more than a penal colony for England's least wanted, as far away from England as they could get. Those criminals were mostly robbers, murderers, con artists, and women of ill repute. And I should be clear, there were plenty of women among the robbers, murderers, and con artists, but England also just shipped over any sex workers that they didn't want around. Now, those ships would occasionally carry some commanders for the Jamaica station as well, but most of these commanders were more interested in their own fortunes than in the well-being of Jamaica. They were a good match for those robbers and murderers, as well as the nearby neighbors. See, the commanders needed to establish a defense for Jamaica without any support from England or any money. They did so by handing out letters of marque to the captains on Jamaica. There weren't a lot of ships left after the invasion force left, but there were a few smaller vessels in the harbor when they took the island, and those vessels managed to capture a few other Spanish ships, so there was a small privateer fleet when the commanders began handing out letters of marque. Now, among the first and most notorious of the commanders sent to the Jamaica station was a captain named Christopher Mings. Mings sailed for Jamaica in 1655, as soon as word of the conquest reached English shores, and he arrived in early 1656. His ship, the frigate Marston Moor, became almost as famous as its namesake battle, and Mings would be arguably the seminal figure in West Indian English piracy. If Francis Drake were the godfather of English piracy, then Mings is maybe the grandfather. He was a ship captain who fought for the Parliamentarians during the Civil War, hence the name of his ship, and the attack on Jamaica kicked off a war between Spain and England. That was Cromwell's goal, after all. But Mings was sent to Jamaica to defend the island and to prosecute the war. He was told to do so by any means necessary, but he wasn't really given any resources. The means at his disposal were the Marston Moor, the few ships already at Jamaica, some heavy guns, a few sailors, and an island full of thieves and killers. The man who quickly proved to be his top lieutenant wasn't an English official, and he wasn't sent over by the English. He was a Dutch privateer named Edward Mansveldt who had risen to prominence among the privateers on Jamaica. His second-in-command, in the eyes of England at least, was someone we've already mentioned, Edward Morgan. Now, these soldiers and sailors would fight off a couple of Spanish attacks early on in 1656, but then they went on the offensive. Mings, Mansveldt, and Morgan chased after a Spanish treasure galleon passing by Jamaican waters, but they failed to catch her. However, they moved on to raiding coastal settlements in Venezuela. They chose that stretch of coastline because it was far from the Spanish naval strongholds in Panama, Cartagena, or Maracaibo. They returned with 20 chests full of Spanish silver, as well as a bunch of new ships and a bunch of goods on board. But then Christopher Mings committed a terrible crime, something that would later on get him in a serious bit of trouble, but that crime was the defining characteristic of the privateers, of the buccaneers, and especially of the pirates. After he returned, he divvied up the plunder. Now, this was not yet routine privateer policy. Privateers were a large and varied group, but it was something that started among the privateers. A lot of their captains did dole out the plunder into equal shares. However, Christopher Mings wasn't a privateer. He was a sub-commander of the Jamaica station and a vice admiral in the Navy. He was supposed to turn all of his plunder over to his superior and then allow him to pay out proper wages. But the Jamaican buccaneers didn't care for that plan. The deal, the reason that they were on that voyage in the first place, the reason that this entire plan could happen, hinged upon those shares, equal shares. Likely, if Mings had gone back on his word and tried to change the deal, they would have killed him. In all, the shares handed out to the buccaneers came to about 250,000 pounds sterling, and that was all money that England would not receive. When news of this came out, Mings was ordered to sail the Marston Moor back to England, and he was briefly imprisoned. No one was quite as suited as Christopher Mings to lead the Jamaican privateers. And Jamaica, without his influence, continued her decline into decadence, into debauchery, and into outright piracy. One planter on the island, a man named Mr. Wolsey, wrote of the, quote, "wild, dissolute, and tattered men," end quote, that populated Jamaica. A priest who was visiting described the, quote, "torrent of wickedness and vice rushing through the streets," end quote. And Thomas Modiford, who will become important later, wrote, quote, "the Spaniards wondered much at the sickness of our people, until they knew the strength of their drinks. Then they wondered more that they were not all dead," end quote. Taverns, brothels, violence, sin, and rum were everywhere in Jamaica, at least wherever the English resided. This state of affairs continued, with the English taking little notice, until, in 1661, the Commonwealth was officially dissolved and Charles II was restored to the throne of England. Remember that heir that the Admiral Penn attempted to take his fleet to? Remember that young man who was steeped in Catholicism and the belief of divine right of kings? Well, he was now King of England. More on that at another date. The government of King Charles, though, saw fit to officially make Jamaica a colony, and they sent out a mission with supplies and arms and a proper governor to secure the island for England. In honor of the new king and their being made a colony, they named the primary fortress of the three fortresses guarding Cagway Bay Fort Charles, and they named the town that was quickly growing up around it Port Royal. In 3 years, three different governors would come and go. There were the New World diseases that were part of the problem, but even more than that, the lawless, drunken, violent, decadent culture of Port Royal was a big issue for them. The priests and the pedigreed of English society didn't know how to deal with Port Royal and all of the prostitutes and privateers that thrived there. But England knew who did know how to deal with that: Christopher Mings. So they sent him back to Port Royal. The privateers there, including Edward and Harry Morgan, celebrated Christopher Mings' return to Port Royal with a raid on Santiago de Cuba, a well-fortified city on the southern coast of Cuba. However, remember our mantra today? The Spanish didn't have enough soldiers to guard the forts or man the guns within. The soldiers were not well trained, their guns were in disrepair, and their ships were not seaworthy. After the raid, Mings and the fleet returned to Port Royal, and all of his subordinates, including Mansvelt and the Morgans, suddenly were very rich and very popular. But his next exploit, Mings' big plan, would prove to be the greatest pirate raid in the West Indies since the time of Francis Drake. He was going to attack Campeche on the Gulf coast of New Spain. This was big news, and word got around. Campeche was large and rich and well defended. No force of pirates or privateers had ever successfully captured it before. Everyone who found out about this raid wanted in, and Mings needed all of them. Abraham Blaufelt sailed over from the Mosquito Coast with three vessels, three of the best pirate ships in the West Indies, in fact. They were captured Spanish galleons manned by seasoned veteran sailors. The buccaneers from Tortuga sent over four frigates. All four were not under the command of Francois Lalonnais, not yet, but he was one of the four captains among them, and it's also highly probable that Roque Basiliano was there as well. Edward Morgan captained the frigate Marston Moor. He and Harry were something of a pair of leaders among the Welsh and English that had been on Jamaica since the 1655 invasion, and they had 10 or so additional ships. And then Edward Mansvelt commanded the vice-admiral of the fleet, the frigate Griffin, Christopher Mings sailed the flagship, a 40-gun, fourth-rate ship of the line, HMS Centurion. Now, Christopher Mings had gathered up nearly every buccaneer and pirate in the West Indies to sail with him. There were a ton of smaller craft sitting idle in harbors across the Caribbean. Their crews, rather than miss out because of the size of their ships, decided to sign up with one of the larger vessels to get a cut of the fat prize that awaited them in Campeche. This fleet of 20 ships set sail from Jamaica with more than 1,400 privateers, buccaneers, and pirates aboard in January 1663. They sailed northwest to round the Yucatan and entered the Gulf of Mexico. They arrived at San Francisco de Campeche on 8 February. Mings landed 1,000 men just down the coast from the city, while Mansvelt led the fleet into the harbor to open fire. You might recognize this tactic from earlier. The arrival of the fleet raised the alarm in Campeche, and it ensured that all Spanish eyes and Spanish guns were pointed at the harbor so Mings could attack by land, and he did so at 8 a.m. All right, say it with me now. The Spanish didn't have enough soldiers to guard the forts or man the guns within. The soldiers were not well trained, their guns were in disrepair, and their ships were not seaworthy. Actually, though, in this case, the soldiers were very well trained. They were disciplined. Campeche was not a backwater. They knew how to defend their city. They used the local topography and the slanted roofs of the buildings in town to stay out of reach of the pirates and rain fire down on them. Every step that the pirates took was through a hail of musket balls. This was an admirable and honorable defense by the soldiers of Campeche. However, there were only 150 of them. They faced 1,000 pirates. There was no way they were going to win this battle. Eventually, they surrendered, once a third of their number had been killed, and they turned Campeche over to the pirates. Specifically, they turned it over to Edward Mansvelt, because Christopher Mings had been injured in the fighting and pulled back to his ship. Now, Mings would eventually return to England to recover from his wounds. I wouldn't feel bad for him, though. He would go on to be the Vice Admiral under James, Duke of York, Lord High Admiral, and the future King of England. He was doing fine. However, Mings wouldn't return alone. He would travel in the company of the Governor of Jamaica. Nobody important at this point, but that would leave Jamaica and Port Royal leaderless. There was Mansvelt, who was leading the buccaneers at this point, but he couldn't actually hold office. He was a leader among the buccaneers, but he was Dutch. He did lead the entire fleet to victory and back to Port Royal with several 100,000 pieces of eight and 14 new ships, and that's to say nothing of the logwood, wine, and iron they brought back. Now, the wine and iron are good things to have, but a quick note about logwood. It's a particular type of tree that produces a deep red dye. The scientific name, from the Greek, literally means bloodwood. It was extraordinarily valuable, almost as valuable by weight as indigo, and later on it's going to play a much larger role in our story, but poaching logwood was the go-to off-season job for many pirates in the West Indies, and it grew like crazy in Campeche. In fact, it still does. At this point, due to the silver and mostly the logwood, the buccaneers who returned were all wealthy, happy, and very drunk. There was also nobody, aside from another buccaneer, Mansvelt, to tell them what to do. So things got a little wild in Port Royal. One man reportedly paid 500 pieces of eight to see a woman loosen her blouse. Another bought cask upon cask of wine and set them up in the street so that everyone who passed by could have a drink. You know how sometimes, when you get pretty toasty, you're more prone to expressions of love and admiration toward your friends? You know, you might roughhouse with them, you might scrap it up or fight a duel to the death, but in the end, you hug it out and it's all, "I love you, man." Well, something like that was happening in the wake of the raid on Campeche. Something was being built there in Port Royal. There was a coalition of French, Dutch, and English pirates and privateers who had just enjoyed a major victory, and they were drinking to their success. They were forming bonds here, and friendships, and loose alliances. They had learned through this raid who was trustworthy and who could get the job done. Harry Morgan was there at Campeche, and he was there in Port Royal, drinking and fighting and enjoying all the finer things and being a part of the birth of this alliance. Much later on, he would give it the name by which we know it today, the Brethren of the Coast. Now that was all well and good for now, but Port Royal needed a leader. England would eventually send someone, but in the meantime, the men chose Harry's uncle, Edward Morgan. Edward was a privateer, but he wasn't a buccaneer. He was a navyman going back. He was something of a gentleman, and he was a family man. He'd brought over his wife, along with his daughter Elizabeth and his two young sons. I'm certain that he enjoyed a few rounds with his men, but he didn't get up to the debauchery that everyone else did. Now, Harry lived with Edward and his family most of the time. Edward's kids, though, were a bit younger than he was. Now, just in case you haven't yet put the pieces together, Harry, spelled with an I in this case, is a Welsh name that the English often anglicized to Henry. Hence, Henry Morgan. But the year that Edward Morgan became acting governor, the second Anglo-Dutch War broke out. As commander of the Jamaica station, now, Edward led a 600-man force to attack the Dutch island St. Eustatius. Remember our mantra? The Dutch had plenty of soldiers to man the forts and the guns within. The soldiers were exceptionally well trained, their guns were oiled and primed, and their ships were seaworthy and powerful. This raid was actually the first action of the Second Anglo-Dutch War, and it ended in a terrible defeat for the English. Edward died in the attack, as did much of the privateer force. Now Mansveldt wasn't there at this raid on a Dutch colony. Since he was Dutch, he didn't want to attack them. But Henry Morgan wasn't there either. He was busy executing a dashing, exciting, dangerous act of buccaneering, which we'll talk about next time. But the defeat would leave the Brethren of the Coast and the population of Port Royal in a state of leaderless uncertainty. Edward Mansveldt stepped forward to lead the Brethren, but he was growing old, and faith in his capability was waning among the buccaneers, and he wasn't even capable of leading the English in any sort of official capacity, so he named a young, strong up-and-comer as his second in command. Henry Morgan would return from his months-long, dashing, exciting buccaneering raid, and he would be rich and famous and popular among the buccaneers. So Mansveldt named him the Vice Admiral to the Brethren of the Coast. Next time, the entire story of Henry Morgan, come hell or high water. I'd like to thank everybody for listening. I'd like to thank everybody who has helped to support the show, including everybody who has signed up to become a patron on Patreon, everybody who has given us a review or a rating, and everybody who has recommended this show. Without all of you, I wouldn't be able to do this, so thank you. Our theme music was, as always, The Old Captain by the fantastic band Brillig. If you haven't checked them out yet, I certainly suggest you do so. You can find them at brillig.com.au. That's brillig.com.au. After you're done over there, why not check out our website at piratehistorypodcast.com, or you can get in touch on Twitter, SoundCloud, or YouTube. As always, and most importantly, thank you for listening. From
for the old captain has died. Let him live on in legend tonight.